recording. Yep, okay, it's going. So we do record this, and we put all of our workshops and seminars as on our podcast series, so I recommend go look at our website, because there's a whole bunch of other podcasts and workshops that are... What?
I didn't know we had a podcast. That's awesome.
How long have you been working here? We have
not that
a podcast.
Long.
welcome to How to Lead a Volunteer Crew. If anyone else trickles in, we'll just get them up to speed. So let's go ahead and go to the first slide. So we did just a little bit about ourselves, but if you want to do a little bit more about your background, so you kind of know where we're coming from, because we have a very interesting mix of crew and volunteer management experience between the three of us.
Yes. So I'm Camille Holthaus. During the day, I work at Gopher Stage Lighting, and I've been I'm trained as a lighting designer, and I've been doing work here at Theater of the Round since 1999, including going through a lot of different volunteer coordinators we've had in that time, and running a lot of crews, running other people's crews sometimes when that's not their strength. And I also do volunteer work that's not theater-based, where I am wrangling volunteers mostly at event or conference venues.
Cool. I'm Corey Scolds. I'm the technical director here at TRP, as well as the technical director and scenic designer at Hopkins High School. Along with that, I freelance as a carpenter, scenic designer, props designer at theaters all around the Twin Cities. As far as managing volunteer crews, a lot of it happens here, a lot of it's happened at the high school, so I've worked with different age groups and different skill levels as well, which makes for a lot of good volunteer leading experience.
And then I'm Sadie Ward. I'm on the board of directors here actually at Theater in the Round. I'm also on the tech advisory board. I've been designing here at Theater in the Round for 11 years now, and do a bunch of freelance around town, so a variety of leading paid crews and volunteer crews at different theaters. My regular day job is in HR at the Guthrie. Prior to that, I was the HR and volunteer coordinator at the Ordway, so also some event volunteer management experience, organizing upwards of 75 volunteers in a day for an event kind of a thing. We'll go on to introductions of yourselves so we can hear a little bit about what you're interested in kind of getting out of this presentation. You don't have to answer all of the questions on the screen. Those are just a couple prompts. So just to kind of let us know who you are, if you've been at TRP before, what you're hoping to get out of here, out of this session. Have you led volunteers before? And just in general, your relationship to the theater industry. Any and all of those, you're welcome to answer. So, I'm going to put you on the spot first.
I have been at the theater before. I'm actually helping with her, assisting with the design for Black Comedy and the designing for Dog Lodger.
Yep.
Opening up, getting a better handle on how to do it better. I stopped doing it coming up. And I have led volunteers before. I worked in the sound and lighting design aspect of high school community theaters, and most of my crew is volunteers. But I know I'm the crew, a volunteer crew of high schoolers, not so much the adult. That's the word.
I plan on volunteering here, but I have not done so yet. I actually went to Hopkins High School here, where I was tech director. And I remember during the Yankees, you assigned me shift captain, which I did badly ask. Yeah, other people just sort of kind of took on a bunch of those rules. But yeah, I want to know how to do that better.
Sweet.
My name is Robbie. I'm the volunteer coordinator for Hennepin Theater Trust. Have I been to TRP before? Yes, several times in college and as a patron and as a general lover of the theater world. As like my organization is changing and the things that we want to do with volunteers are changing, especially activating our event center space, more as a performance space, the utilization of volunteers and doing roles that are very similar to crew work is going to become very integral, so I'm hoping to learn a lot of how y'all do that and how y'all kind of make that run super smoothly, because this Have I led volunteers before? Yes, that's my job. and relationship to the theater, love it, it's in my blood.
It's great.
Awesome.
Generally speaking, we know that there's volunteers in most theaters on some level. Here at Theater in the Round, specifically as a community theater, we have volunteers kind of integrated throughout. So we have them in the box office, they work as ushers, various special events, concessions, tech opportunities, which is the focus of this presentation, but a lot of the concepts that we're talking about are very applicable to any kind of volunteer management, I think. Directors, designers, actors as well, at least here at TRP. Just to give you a sense of what volunteering at TRP means, it kind of means a little bit of everyone. So.
Well, and I always say TRP has had to figure this out because they do 9 shows a year, all with volunteers. And so you don't do that year in and year out without figuring out something.
Yeah, there are only 7 of us on staff. Everybody else in the building is volunteer. Yep.
So there's kind of a couple different kind of ways we're going to structure this presentation. It's kind of the getting ready, when volunteers walk through the door, when you actually have volunteers, and then follow up, just as kind of a rough structure to our presentation. So broadly speaking, and we're going to kind of each speak from kind of our own individual area. Camille having a lighting background, Corey having the carpentry background, and I'm going to focus a little bit in more like a scenic paint background. So before anyone shows up, you have to get ready. So anyone else can jump in at this point.
Sure. Well, so one of the things that I see, particularly with lighting folks, is when they do their first few designs, it's usually them and maybe them and a couple friends. And that's, you need a really different kind of prep to be coming in and working with a crew of people that some of which you may not know, or coming in with a lot of different skill levels. So. Paperwork becomes really important because that's how you communicate consistently through a crew call, particularly if you're also going to work alongside them. And a little later we're going to talk about how do you decide how you're leading. But so for lighting designers, it's super important that you have like a coherent plot that has a key on it and is easy to read, that you can explain to people how to do the work. Different styles of stages lend themselves to different ways of doing that, but in general, you have to have paperwork that communicates exactly what they're going to do. Supplies and tools for lighting is pretty basic, like you should have your wrenches and your stuff, but if you're going to do a call that's going to do a hang and a focus all together, you need to have your supplies for every step. Like, you do not want to be taking a break and pulling your gel and cutting your gel and figuring out your gobos while your crew is hanging. Like, you need to come in and do that ahead of time. You need to be ready so that you can stay engaged the entire time. And that's kind of that last piece, too. If you're going to get your crew to do some of the pieces, you know, often, like here we have gel files. So we might hand a list off. You know, grab these pieces of gel that are this size, this quantity. But that means that list has to be really organized and coherent, and someone else has to be able to read it. Typed is awesome. So you want paperwork that communicates to people who don't know you and that they can keep working without asking you for every next step.
Mm-hmm. The carpentry path kind of follows that as well, but your whatever paperwork or rendering or working drawing you have, it was always stressed to me that that's a communication tool. So you need to have, for your visual learners, you know, you have to have the pieces all fitting together so that you can see if diagrams are helpful to people, that works. If having typed out instructions, whatever, you know, trying to approach it from a level that if one person does better with written instructions, one person better with verbal, you know, you've got to kind of plan for each of those, even if you yourself might be more of a visual learner, still kind of thinking of what that other people might like. As far as supplies and tools go, there's an expression in the cooking world called mise en place, which is it's a French everything in its place. But that is very much, you know, I like to set out my materials ahead of time, my tools ahead of time, make sure that everything's working, make sure that everything's safe beforehand, so that when the call starts, I can look like I have all the answers and know where everything is, rather than just saying, oh, it's hidden over there somewhere, or making things up on the spot.
And then kind of to offset paperwork in some ways, like for a paint call, you need to have a certain amount of like either paint elevations or research images. I find for painting, you know, there's some things where you maybe have a very specific thing that you're going for. So I helped lead the crews on this set. So this floor was a very particular kind of look that we were going for, but the walls, we were like, it feels like this. So I think part of that, you know, is reflected in what kind of visuals you bring for people to literally see, because I think that's something that is important, you know, in more of a like you're just kind of like making it up on a certain point with painters, to be able to be like, it needs to be exactly like this, or in this image, this is exactly what I'm trying to capture. Versus like if you maybe have some research images where you're like, this is the feel that we're going for. Cause like with the rocks, it was like, you know, this kind of moss, but like this kind of shape. So you're kind of blending those two things together. I think in the most ideal world, you would have a perfect rendering and elevation every time, but that doesn't always happen. So, you know, that's where I always view it in a way of like, if I'm leading a crew and like, let's say I'm sick the day of the call, I want to make sure that I have left enough paperwork that someone else could conceivably come in and run that crew. Kind of like in that idea of like stage managers have the prompt book, like have enough detail and like what Corey said about a communication tool that hopefully if you're doing it right, someone should be able to like come in and pick it up and run. Other like kind of paperworky things as it relates to painting is like, so the rocks that you see on the Modesty panels here were actually 7 layers of paint. So I like wrote out each step. And that was then when I got to the point of actually leading a crew for these, I was like, okay, am I going to have a crew, one person, like literally sequence through every step, like each of the 7 steps, or am I just going to have one person do one step? And that's what I did the latter, because it was much easier for me to be like, okay, you're going to do the toning. And then the person kind of worked their way around the mod. It was in the shop, not on stage. So I had one person do one layer, and then another person follow behind, and then a third person follow behind. So, you know, it was three or four people at once working on the same things. But because there were 7 layers, I assigned each person a different thing. So, and that took a lot of thought, you know, ahead of time. I had to know what I could offer to people, because I liked... In my paint calls, you know, especially when you don't know when people are, you don't know what skill level they are, I like to have like, okay, this is like the no-brainer part. This is base coating. You would have to try and mess this up. And then I have the more like, if you want to learn something, here's this. And then I have like my experts where I'm like, oh, you know how to do this, just do it. So I like to, like, as I'm thinking of those steps of how to break that down, try and make sure that I have kind of a split of skills of like, if I know I have someone that knows nothing about paint, I've got something that I, you know, can base coat them, have set them to base coat. So that kind of thinking goes in to some of the communication paperwork that I put together as well. So making a plan, so we kind of touched on this a little bit, I think, as we were talking about getting ready. But I think kind of for each, I think we talked about doing this, each of us just go through the bullet points on this one? Okay, you go first.
Okay. So when I'm making a plan, sorry, my calf just decided to cramp up. So when I'm looking at a crew, like here, our crew is, part of our crews are brought in through the volunteer coordinator. We might also bring individuals that we bring in ourselves. And so I usually know how many people, subtract 1 or 2 for life happening. I usually don't know what they know, and I certainly don't know what their expectations are. But from prior experience, what I ran into with crews that weren't working well when someone else was running them, which was kind of how I learned, was watching other people. Most people who show up want to work. And so if what they're doing is standing around, they're probably not happy. And so there's some sort of general expectations you can put in place for volunteer crews in particular, is they've shown up for a reason. they have some passion. But your plan needs to be flexible because you don't know. Also, even sometimes our repeat person that you do know, maybe they're having a bad day. Maybe they, for some reason, decided to volunteer at the end of a long day of work. You know, you have to be a little flexible even with volunteers you are familiar with. Alongside or supervising or switching back and forth, it kind of I think some of it has to do with how big your crew is and what their skill levels are, and also where your energy is best put. So for a lighting crew call, one of the things I learned early on is I'm usually the last one out. So if I'm expecting most of my crew is going to get out about 10 or 10:30 and I want to finish something, maybe I'm not climbing ladders from 7 to 9 because I'm climbing ladders from 10:30 to 12. So there's sometimes it's judging your own energy. Sometimes it's judging, like, do I need to be next to them showing them a technique or an idea? Or do I need to be lending my energy of being like, look, I'm up and down the ladder as much as you are? And for, I think for adult volunteers, they expect less, like, side-by-side. Mm-hmm. Like, let me prove to you I can do the thing. How many things can happen at once? How many things can you successfully supervise? And this takes just practice. For lighting, one of the things I found is I can keep large focus groups busy because I've focused in this space so many times I know how to break it up so that I've got one group that's shifting from one location to another while I'm working with a different group. And I know how many people and how long it's going to take me. Do I have three people up on ladders at a time? And I know what that looks like. And that's about how much time it takes for this other group to move their ladders. Do I have someone that I can just turn loose and say, there's some designers who come in and help with crew. And I'll be like, hey, these six lights, they do this thing. It's super basic. Please just do it. And they can talk to the board op themselves and do their own stuff. So it's really helpful to know how you can break your crew down. Like what you were talking with the painting too, is like, how does this work? I think it's more important to keep everybody occupied than to show that you can multitask. But when you can multitask, you really are able to leverage your time. So what order do things have to happen in? Lighting's pretty basic. But like, at what point are you going to pull someone to go off a ladder to go grab gel? You know, that kind of, you know, I'm going to bring people in. We need to get out the ladders. We need to make sure everybody knows what they're doing. We need to get them up and hanging here. We hang in cable together, and then we drop gel and focus together. Like, what is this what's typical in the space you're in? So even some of those real basics of what your crews are used to. We teach designers who are new here often, like, okay, look, our crews come in year after year, and here's what they're used to. Please don't mess with some of the basics. Like, we're not going to hang and then go back and cable everything. It doesn't make sense in this space. But I've worked on one's catwalk systems where that absolutely makes sense. So expectations again. So what do you need to get done? Like, what's your goal for the night, actual scenario? I've been here long enough, I know a general rule of thumb of how many lights per person per hour can get hung and cabled in here. That kind of information is really helpful. Talking to people who've worked in a space or worked in events, like how long, what's the realistic expectation? And then best case, make sure, like, so for lighting, again, it's pretty easy. If we get everything hung and cabled and turning on, maybe we'll start focus. Maybe we'll send everyone home early, but, you know, it's good to have an idea. You don't want it suddenly to be 8:30 on a 7 to 10 call and you don't know what everybody's doing. And worst case, that, you know, how are you going to move stuff forward if you get really delayed? What happens if you only get a three-quarter hung? You know, can you fold it into your next crew call, or are you having to start to get a hold of the volunteer coordinator and say, I need to add another crew call? Like, be aware of that. That's pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Again, the carpentry kind of echoes a lot of what the lighting designer has. Knowing how many volunteers you have, how many people you can expect to work with, how many volunteers are realistic in a shop space, being in a room full of, you know, spinning blades and sparks flying and sawdust and things like that, it is important to know, like, all right, I can't realistically keep 20 people safe and occupied in this room. And that does, again, fall into how many projects can you have going at any given time. And that kind of ties into the goals and things. But, you know, if you're working on 4x8 flats or 4x10 walls or something big, and you've got limited real estate in the shop, knowing how many things you can have going at one time and how limited you are by your workspace becomes a factor as well. And I feel like that translates too into other areas, but just knowing the space that you're in and how much it can realistically hold, or, you know, you can be spatter painting in the shop, but maybe you don't want to be spatter painting on the stage floor after it's already done. And certainly probably not in the lobby. The working alongside or supervising thing, for me, a lot of the time that comes down to what the project is and kind of personal preference as well. You know, if I feel like I'm better working alongside, just because I've spent all the time drafting up the thing and thinking about how it fits together in my head and everything like that. But at the same time, if I've got a huge crew and I know that realistically people are going to have questions and I need to make myself available for that, so me getting stuck in on a project is probably not the ideal solution for that day. That being said, if it's one or two volunteers and we're working on the same thing, it's pretty easy to kind of feel that rhythm out at the beginning of the call. I would say typically I plan all my calls as if I'm going to be supervising the whole time, and then if it looks like I have the opportunity to keep myself busy with something else, like if I get a free moment, that's when I'm going to start a project, or that's when I might jump in on somebody else and work alongside them. How many things can happen at once? Again, we talked about space, real estate. And then, again, touching on, you know, what are your volunteers, what are their comfort levels? How much are they aware of? Have they used a table saw before? Have they used a chop saw? And do they say they've used these tools before, but not actually, or have they used them once? You know, figuring out if someone can be safely left alone or not so much. Because it is, in the shop, safety is very much a concern. And I live in constant fear of the day that I turn around and someone just says, "Corey, help." So knowing, you know, how much space and how much space people take up when they work. I have some volunteers that will spread out, you know, take up half the floor, and I have some people that keep everything in like a little condensed 1x1 square of all of their tools. And it's just kind of figuring out as you go. Order becomes pretty important in the shop as well. You know, does it need to be built first? Does it need to be base coated, then assembled, things like that. So just having all of that thought out before you can set people loose on something. Because I feel like it's a lot easier to say, like, all right, this is step one, this is step two, this is step three. Does any of that not make sense? Great, go for it. And then I'm free to start the next group on something. That best case, actual, and worst case is something that one of my college TDs kind of stressed to me. So when I'm putting my build schedule and my calendar together, I kind of plan for this is the date that I would hope the set is complete by. This is the date the working set is hopefully complete by. If we get these things done, maybe we could get it done early and then I could have a day off or something as my best case. Or I could start working on the next show or whatever. And then having a plan for that. All right, if it gets to this date and I don't have these things done, this is what I need to do to fix that. You know, if it's the week before the show and I'm still building walls in the shop, how many more people do I need? Who do I call? What favors do I pull in? But just not being surprised by things not going to plan is really crucial, I feel like. And then that smaller goals thing kind of ties into, you know, like we said, volunteers like to be working. They like to be kept busy. They like to contribute. So acknowledging when you finish a project or kind of making sure that people are aware, like, all right, that one's done, and that's awesome, and that's a thing crossed off the list. There's a lot of people that are really satisfied by crossing something off a list, or like if you have a pile of working drawings and you can X out the ones that are finished, you know, just acknowledging that something's been checked off the list, I feel like, is a big morale booster.
So as it relates to paint, I usually think of like the big schedule first. So since I've been at TRP enough, I know that generally speaking, you have about 5 weeks to paint. You know, 4 to 6, kind of depending on like what the set is and what is being built. So I usually like to put my goals in a calendar format first, in terms of like, okay, this week I know I need it base coated. This week I want it wood grained. This week I know I'm going to do the stonework, so that I've got those goals first. And then that, to me, the goals then inform all of the other steps as it relates to painting. Because when it, at least my general approach to painting is at the end of the day, if I don't have volunteers show up, I'm going to paint it myself. I would always prefer that volunteers show up because I think it, you know, helps the theater. It helps, gives people opportunities to learn and, you know, be engaged in the community aspect of the community theater. But, you know, at the end of the day, the show does open, so you need to have those goalposts in there because paint is something that can pile up on you super fast if you're not chunking away at it. So that's where kind of having the big goals and the smaller goals kind of then relate to how many people I need. Especially the working alongside versus supervising. So for myself, like, I know if I just set someone off to base coat, generally I'm not working alongside them, so I know I can be doing something else. Whereas what this stone project ended up being, I was, you know, one of the people doing the steps. So I was working alongside while also keeping an eye on things, because paint is a little different in that, you know, there's some volunteers that I know and I can just like give them a project and literally walk away for 4 hours and it's totally fine. And then there's kind of that balance of like someone's new, so they might say something about their expectations and I'm like, okay, I'm going to explain this and I'm going to note that I have to check back in 20 or 30 minutes to see if I need to like refine my own instruction, give better direction, or like rarely, I don't think I've ever actually like pulled someone off of a project because I'm always trying to like for myself as a leader refine my own ability to articulate because I want that person to succeed. Because I come from a point of view that I didn't paint until college. So, you know, I, from a volunteer point of view, I believe anyone can learn how to paint. And it's my job as in leading the crew to help that person understand what they need to do technically to achieve something artistically. So that's kind of when I'm thinking of alongside or supervising, that kind of philosophy kind of informs. You know, there's some instances where I have walked in and someone literally off the street walks in and I'm like, whoa, this person can paint. I don't have to do anything with this person. And then there's some instances where I'm like, okay, like this person's doing a really good job, but it's taking them like 13 times as long as it would take me to do this. So that's kind of that balance that I kind of take into account of like, what was my goal? When does this have to be done? If this person is getting a great experience out of it, I'm going to let them do it. And then I'm going to zhuzh things around later because I want them to feel ownership when they come and see the show. Mm-hmm. Because I'm kind of a world that you should never repaint something because I think that's really rude. Those kinds of things are kind of always kind of shifting in my mind a little bit. And it goes back to that main plan of like, if I thought I was going to wood grain at this, you know, have all the wood grain done and it's Thursday and I've got none of it, I know that for myself, I got to come in and crank it out. And that's kind of where, as the leader, I kind of view myself as filling the gap of what work needs to get done, of what the crew can do, what I can do to make them be successful and still make the show go on.
So. Something I thought of while you two were talking is, the other thing is particularly here, lighting designers run their own crews through the whole process. And as a designer, I also am working through what can I not do. So if I have infinite amount of time, then we might focus, and particularly when we had fewer instruments and fewer circuits, we would focus. I would have a big crew focus, and then I would come in Saturday morning before dry tech, and I would touch almost every single light because the focus in here is so fussy. I was also learning how to teach people how to focus, and like there was a lot going on with that early on. But you know, now we have more stuff. But that Saturday morning was something that could have not happened if we were behind on something else. So I always have the like, well, yeah, I could perfect this, and the show has to open, and I have to be sane when it opens. So you're always kind of balancing. And here, community theater, we all work elsewhere. This isn't our profession. This isn't how we pay our rent or mortgage. So you're also balancing other life aspects, and you have to keep all of that in mind. But kind of as you go, there's always that, well, we could do that last step, and what are you paying to do that last step, and is that something you could drop because you've gotten behind? So
I like what you're saying about being a designer and leading a crew, because I find sometimes it's actually more difficult when I'm the designer and doing the crew work, or, you know, leading the crew work, because I am making the decision in that moment sometimes, because I'm sitting there thinking, okay, that doesn't look quite like I thought it would, but is that okay? Do I really need to do this? Whereas, like, instances where I'm like, here's the thing, lead the crew, that is almost easier for me in some ways, because I'm like, if it's not that, then we got to do it. It's not my decision to make. It's when you're making the decision on top of leading people that that can be the most, like, you know, supervising aspect of things, because you're making the decisions as it's happening in front of you sometimes.
Yeah. And if you're not someone who switches gears like that very well, be aware of that, and just don't be making decisions when you have a crew in. So, like, that's some of the planning, but, like, I know for some of the stuff I have that ability now after doing this for long enough. But it's a different way of thinking. So, like, be aware of where you're at with your skill level and mm-hmm. with who's in the room.
Day of the call. So you've done all the effective planning, and sometimes you make a plan and then it all goes out the window the day of the call. That's everyone's favorite. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's a couple key basics that I think are true regardless of what area you're going to be in. Greeting and getting things started. I think it's just a human thing to greet people, but sometimes when you've got so many things in your mind, sometimes it just flies out and you're like, okay, we got to get to work. But you got to remember, like, especially in my mind, whether it's volunteer or an employee, you got to keep that human aspect in mind. And then just certain technical things, like, especially if it's volunteers where there's any kind of, like, credit, like making sure that they sign in on any kind of call board. And really, I find right at the kind of start of the day, you're kind of setting the tone for the rest of the day. You know, when someone comes in and you're like, I'm just thinking of lighting calls that I've been on, and it's like, here's the bag of Twizzlers. And yes. Then here's the lighting plot. Has a different thing than here's the lighting plot, and then, like, an hour later, you're like, can I have a Twizzler? Like, that informs your whole experience, right?
We like Twizzlers because your fingers don't get sticky.
That's true.
Well, and for setting the tone of the call, one of the things, so lighting crew almost always has a mix of skill levels. Like I did in talking about, like, touching the grid, I almost always try, when I'm talking to people, try to communicate some way that I have made a mistake in doing the hangs to make it easier for them to learn. Here, one of the big ones is if you start the first few lights correctly, where they are placed on the grid, you could hang off of that, right? If those first few lights are in the wrong place and everybody starts hanging off of it, then it's a mess. And so when I'm trying to convince people that it's super important to, like, triple check your first few fixtures, I always tell the story about the time when I got to stand on a ladder and literally go from pipe to pipe with 6 fixtures. So I'm like, make it easy for people to make a mistake. Make it easy for people to ask questions. Make it easy for them to admit what they do and don't know. I think helps you all the way down through the entire process.
Totally.
So
I'd say there's something to be said about, like, getting a feel for the energy of your volunteers as well. Because, you know, you want to come in and your greeting is, you want to be energetic and friendly and helpful, but at the same time, you don't want to be, like, insincere or overly cheerful. You kind of want to get a feel for how your crew is doing that day and kind of come up with the energy level or the tone that they need. You know, if you have people that respond better to kind of being set loose on projects, or if you have people that really are going to, you know, want to talk through every individual detail first before they touch anything. So just kind of getting that energy level and knowing how to function as a leader and what kind of tone you need to use, I would say.
Mm-hmm. The energy of the room, I think of sometimes in terms of, like, introverts and extroverts as well. Because at least in painting, sometimes, like, I literally have a bunch of introverts show up for a crew and I'll be like, hey, la la la. And I'm like, no one's talking. Got it. Okay, we're just going to paint today. And then sometimes you have, you know, a call of extroverts where, you know, you can be, you know, painting and chatting at the same time. And sometimes, like, I've literally experienced both based off of who comes in the door. And sometimes you know your volunteers and you know who your introverts and your extroverts are, and sometimes there's also the scenario where maybe you were expecting someone, they didn't show up, but someone else showed up. So even when you kind of try and plan for some of that, which I think is kind of fun, it keeps me on my toes, kind of that keeping the energy of the room going, because kind of what Camille said, people want to feel useful, because that's, like, there is nothing more, like, valuable someone can give than their time for free at the end of the day. Like, that is how someone is just choosing to spend their free time, which I think is really important to kind of keep in mind, that someone is here by choice. They're not getting paid to be here. You know, there are certain things in other scenarios where you can be like, well, you're getting paid, so this is the job, and it needs to be done. But for volunteers, that's really not kind of the given understanding of the situation. And the last bullet point there, you are an ambassador for the theater. You know, having worked freelance in a couple of other theaters, especially when you have a mix of volunteers, some who are seasoned, and, you know, any theater you go to, there's always going to be that volunteer, and it's their first call. So, you know, it's kind of that what they see at face value, that's their experience of the theater in and of itself. So I think that that's also something, if you're, like, going to other theaters, to kind of understand what the theater's expectation for volunteers is as well, because there's you as your own personal entity and your own philosophies and beliefs. But if you're the person, you know, the designer that's getting paid to lead other volunteers, you know, I might lead a crew slightly differently here than I might at another theater, just based on kind of the given understanding of what it means to volunteer at one theater versus another. You know, there's some theaters where they literally track every single hour that you volunteer, and there's a point system. Here at Theater in the Round, you could volunteer 100 hours on one show, but you get the same set of comps that anyone else does. You know, those kind of inform the cultures that develop in volunteer pools. And when you are leading the crew, whether you want it or not, you are the ambassador for that crew in that call.
Got it. Make sure people want to come back.
Communication, everyone's favorite. We all think we're good at it, and rarely is anyone perfect at it, mostly because there's different communication styles. I know for myself, leading events kind of outside of kind of tech things, I would always try and plan a three-pronged communication, like, training style. I would have something in writing. I would try and have a training beforehand, and then I would be prepared to train the day of, because different communication styles respond differently to those. And because I know at the Ordway, when I led the volunteers for the Children's Festival, I had to have those three, because there was no way one of those training methods was going to get everyone. Because, you know, it's just in the way that some people literally like to read before they do something. Some people like to observe before they do something. And some people are like, let's go. I don't know what I'm doing, but we're doing it. So, you know, that's kind of communication manifesting in training styles. But I personally think that communication also is in the base of, like, knowing your own communication style. And I think that that's something that just takes time. There's no way that you can do that without practice. So
talking to different levels of experience, one of the things I've learned with lighting crews, which I suspect flows through in others, is how to triage people out to keep as many people working as possible. So if I have 6 or 7 people showing up, and I'm, you know, as they're coming in, I'm talking to them, and if I don't know their skill level, I'm trying to gauge where we're at. And often bluntly asking, like, have you ever hung a light fixture before? How long ago? And, you know, and then for me, what's really important is the people who know what they're doing, we're going to do an overview. You know, we have the plot. We're going to do an overview. I'm going to be like, okay, this is how this plot is laid out. This is how we keep the, because in here, we keep the table oriented, so it's literally, like, don't spin the table. it's literally the grid over your head, so... And so I'll do a quick overview that for the experienced folks is what they need to get going. And I tell the new folks, I'm like, just wait. This is going to be confusing, and that's okay. I'm going to get these people working. And so also just communicating to people, like, what's happening. It's like, oh, you're my newest folks, so just chill. You follow along as much as you can. You guys, here, dunk, 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 go. okay, so let's talk about what you need a refresher on, or what part of that didn't make sense, or pair them up with an experienced person. And then for my newbies, like literally, we're going to go pick up a fixture, and I'll be like, okay, my arm is the pipe. Let's hang it, you know, do all the things, and then I have them do all the things. But while I'm doing this really intensive training, I've got half my crew is going to town. And if I did it the other way around, we would get a lot less work done. So figuring out how to break that down, and it's not always that order, right, depending on what work you're doing. So I think it's important to understand how your training, because so one of the things about Theater and Ground in terms of culture is we are a teaching organization. Like that is one of our goals, is for people to come here and learn, and really someone can walk in and say, I've never hung a light before. And even though we're in production, this is a show, we have a timetable, built into that is the fact that we're gonna have to teach. So there's other places where that's not true. You're expected to come in with a certain level of knowledge and only be learning what's different here, or mm-hmm. what's, you know, specific to this space. So.
In the scene trap, it echoes a lot of what's been said. Just kind of knowing what your volunteers are gonna respond to, who, as you talk through everything, having those visual aids, having those instructions that you're saying out loud, having things written down that people can refer back to, just making sure that everyone feels like they know what they're getting into before they get started. Whether it's having that conversation about safety, about like, all right, this is why safety glasses are important, or this is the table saw, these are the things you should be aware of. Knowing how to stress that to people to make sure that everyone is feeling confident and comfortable in their workspace. And then that humility thing kind of ties into making it an environment that people are able to ask questions in, and making sure that, you know, no one's going to be scared to ask you how something works for a second time, or making sure that people don't feel dumb because they can't find the on switch to something, or they tried something and it messed up. Just making sure that people are, you know, mistakes are a natural part of art and theater especially. So knowing that there are no dumb questions, there are no waste of time. You know, if someone's not clear on something, we'll go through it as many times as we need to.
The humility piece, I remember my first day of college, our directing professor said, we're all the same person at the core, we just have different layers of experience. And I always remind myself of that sometimes if I have what I might call a challenging volunteer experience, where I'm leading someone, is, you know, because there is always going to be that day where you just want to get stuff done, and no matter how many good questions you want people to ask, you can be like, why are there so many questions and we just need to get stuff done? Like, that's going to be your inner monologue. You know, it's kind of like the calm duck and the feet going. You know, that's the piece where I always have to kind of check myself to say, you know, there was a day when someone had to teach you how to wood grain. Mm-hmm. And you got to keep, you know, you got to check yourself sometimes, because, you know, we all want to learn and we all want to achieve that. This person just hasn't had this experience to be able to do it yet.
Well, and the other thing is, so when I present at conferences, a couple of conferences I present at talk about, we're all learners and we're all teachers in any space we're in. So I've been doing theater for a very long time, but it's never been my full-time profession. I have people come in to work my crews that have done a lot more work than I have, that might know that board better, that might have, you know, might even just have been doing it more recently than I have, whatever it is we're doing. And so I also have to keep that idea of, people are going to bring ideas in or skills in that I should not assume I have nothing to learn just because I'm leading the crew. I always learn, always. And that's true in all of my experiences, and you need to leave open for that. Even I talked with these guys, for lighting designers in particular, we work alone so much, in that most technical crews are not designers and vice versa. Well, designers often do tech, but when you're working with a crew, we're in the habit of thinking of them as technicians. And when you have a designer in your crew, there's always kind of a like, do you actually know what you're doing? Like, do you know, we kind of have to check each other out. And I actually just like put that out in the room. Like, I know this is what we lighting designers do. They do it every place I go. This is how we kind of check each other out and figure out if we think you have the chops. And that's okay. But you have to leave space for that to happen and not be insulted because someone comes in and is like, yeah, I know what I'm doing. And yeah, I know, like, I could have designed this show. Okay. Mm-hmm. But you didn't. It's my show. But let's be open to and to there being learning while not disrupting this process.
I think in some ways in the world of paint, there's even more of that, like, back and forth of things. Because I have definitely, like, gone down a path of being like, okay, you're going to do this, 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 and this. And they're like, you mean this? And I'm like, yeah, that. That was brilliant. Okay, I explained it, like, really convolutedly, and you just did it. So I think the day that you stop being open to hearing and learning is the day you've created a blind spot for yourself.
Even, I mean, I'll hand someone a drawing and they'll come back 20 minutes later and be like, hey, this doesn't physically work. Like, the way you drew this doesn't make any sense. And so that's, yeah, you're never infallible.
And I'm forever hanging lights behind house lights.
Yep.
I just do.
So kind of a continuation of the day of the call. Some of this we've kind of touched on a little bit already, but I think that there were kind of a couple key points we really wanted to reinforce, kind of like, these are the things that I think of, like, you've got the call started, you're feeling really good, you've kind of like, you know, you're into the call and you're kind of really understanding how your call's going at that point. Because it's like, sometimes even my perception at the beginning versus like 2 hours in can be very different. And I think teaching skills to me is also one of the big, you know, the example that you described, Camille, of kind of you set your experienced people off and you take the time to teach skills. There's certain times where, like, my priority is always to teach skills. But again, with that goal overall, like, teaching skills really takes time. And, like, especially depending on where the person is coming from and where they want to get to, you know, my investment in teaching them skills can be different too. It kind of, in my mind, goes to the empowering people to build skills, because that is something that I believe, you know, if I've given them that successful teaching experience, because it's surprising to me sometimes how, at least in the world of paint, people need to have permission to succeed or permission to fail. I always find that really interesting, because I'm like, just go do it. Like, go nuts. Like, mess it up, and then I'll tell you if it's wrong. Rarely has anyone actually messed it up, because a lot of people, you know, are coming to volunteer because they need to build up that confidence level. And, you know, sometimes when you can see that beyond, like, I need to teach you how to scumble, you're going to get a better volunteer long term than I just need to teach you how to scumble.
It's very much the same way in the scene shop. You know, I want to take the time to teach someone the safe way to do it, the way that's going to make sure that no one on stage is going to get hurt, no one in the shop is going to get hurt, and learn all of the rules of how to build something before then saying, all right, this is, you know, we can break a rule here or there. But getting that kind of proper protocol or whatever the situation calls for, making sure that people are know the way to do it before coming up with you just being turned loose and like, all right, here's your drawing, go build the thing. There's also a big deal when it comes to, again, safety a lot. But the way you ask someone how they're doing on a project or how they're doing with a particular tool, you know, is this your first time using the table saw? Do you know how to use that versus is this something you feel comfortable with? Where on a scale of 1 to 10, where are you at with this tool? Like, do you feel safe? And making it so that people feel okay to say that rather than just kind of forcing someone to suffer through using a tool that they don't understand or using something that they're scared of, even if it's for a, you know, not a reason that you wouldn't see as super logical. Like, maybe, you know, you don't know what's going on in people's head. Maybe they've got a noise thing. Maybe there's a fear that you don't know about. So just being able to plan for that situation is really crucial in a scene shop environment.
Well, and one thing about teaching also, I think, is how are you reinforcing it? So, you know, for lighting crews, I'll see people who, like, they want to walk through the whole process. Then they're going to want to, like, bring me, is this the light I'm hanging? Yes. Am I hanging it there? Yes. Go up the ladder. Watch them hang it. Okay. And they want a lot of intervening steps, and that's fine. They want all of those pieces of reinforcement. And I've got some people that are like, yep, okay. And those people I want to check in on, you know, but often pretty subtly. And then, you know, I might wait for them to do two or three right and be like, oh yeah, that looks great. Because what they, you know, those people need different levels of kind of caregiving in terms of their learning and getting that reinforcement. And if I swapped those two, I would have miserable volunteers, right? And some of that's just getting practice or watching how they respond the first time. You know, if I am watching them too closely and they're really uncomfortable, like, oh, okay, this person I need to back off a little bit and just double check maybe from across the arena. And then give them a little bit of, very professional reinforcement. Mm-hmm. But allow people to be where they're at with that, and then you can get everybody up to that level of working at the level they want to be.
My general experience with paint is that I have more people that if they don't know are asking questions because they want to do it right. I always try and assume that the volunteer is coming from a place that they want to do it right. Very few people in this world actually say, I want to mess it up.
Right.
Those people exist, but like, let's not assume that that's most people. I think you'll always have what I call the wild cowboys that just like go off and you just got to wrangle back. Those I find to be the most difficult in terms of like my own skill set to be like, how can I refocus this energy? Because I usually try and frame a situation like that as like, this person has some amazing energy. What do I need to do to tap into that? How can I communicate? How can I motivate that? Because if I can get this energy to be doing what I want them to do, it'll be great. But sometimes it is kind of that feeling like you're wrangling someone back. I think it's rare, but sometimes those experiences stick out to us.
Oh yeah. Well, and I'd say in events, I see that even more is I'll be like, hey, we're going to set up the registration table and it needs to be da-da-da-da-da, because it does need to be done. And somebody is really having problems with that whole like step 1 through 10 thing. I'll be like, you know what? There's a box of decorations over there. Why don't you go make those tables look awesome? They need something where they have more input into what's happening. I'm like, I can do that. Like, I've got these different jobs. And some of them need, you know, but I don't really want to walk through with someone how to decorate the table when there's a box of decorations like that. I'm like, I want someone who's going to be willing to jump in on that on the registration table. I'm willing to stand there and go, put that there, put that there, put that there. So that's also knowing my tolerance for like how much detail I want to get down into, finding the right person to do the right piece.
Mm-hmm. And there's many times where you do swap people.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I jumped ahead.
I did a little bit too.
Yep.
I think we've hit on most of these.
Yep.
Okay.
I think maybe the one bullet point that I want to emphasize is having a reason to justify feedback. At least in the paint world, I can tell that if I'm trying to redirect someone in what they're doing, generally speaking, when I can have a reason for it that they can follow, they're much more likely to get on it than me just being like, just do it this way. Because like most humans don't respond well to that. Just like, I don't even like being told that because I'm always like, well, why? Or like, what am I doing that's wrong? So like, particularly in painting, that's a visual thing. You know, I think of, again, God, these walls were such a good example. You know, like some direction that I was giving, I was like, you have to work faster because there's going to be 5 more layers to this. And then they were like, oh, like once they saw the layers, they were like, got it, I can work faster. Mm-hmm. So it kind of goes both ways in terms of like knowing what corners you can cut, because like in that instance, I was like, what you're doing is beautiful, but it really doesn't need to take that much time. Because especially with all the layers, we could just move. So
I find that with light focus. I mean, there's a whole bunch of light focus in here that's really quick and dirty. Like we're gonna get these areas done. And then all of a sudden I slow down. And I start getting really picky with someone. And sometimes I can hear them getting frustrated. And I'll be just like, you know what? This is the special for the end of the show. I need it exactly right. And then they're on board. Like, oh, okay, yep. this needs to be a really specific, perfect thing. And they'll come along with me. So providing some context for what's super important. The same, not so much with a hang, but sometimes, like, get the area lights up where I drafted them, but and then I'll be like, okay, this thing we actually need to stop, we need to look at it, I need it to be just right, it needs to get yoked out, it needs special treatment, whatever. Mm-hmm. And if you help people understand how it fits in, you know, then also when they come watch the show, they're like, oh, I did the super special spot. Mm-hmm.
Or like in the shop, you know, if there's a mistake, sometimes you have to restart a whole project or rebuild something, and there's nothing worse than asking a volunteer to be like, hey, you know that thing you just spent 2 hours on? We got to redo it. But if you can frame it from like, this is a safety thing, this is, you know, why it has to be a certain way, this is the trapdoor that the actor falls through, and it can't, you know, there can't be any nails sticking out for them to get caught on or whatever. And similarly too, like knowing what from a project can you salvage, or like how can you frame that situation in a way that they don't feel like they spent 2 hours on something that they have to take apart now. Like, can you turn it into like a, this is, you know, you did everything great except this is the one thing that it's slightly different this way, and making that a moment where they don't feel like they've wasted time, or they don't feel like they made a stupid mistake, or if they do feel that way, you know, being able to kind of laugh it off or make it not a big deal, or that kind of ties back into having your goals and like, it's all right, we're ahead of schedule, you know, this thing, it'll take 20 minutes to redo it or whatever. But making it so that even if there is a mistake, it's not a huge deal.
I find sometimes also, like, if a mistake is made, it's a very different experience for a volunteer that you know versus don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Because I actually find for volunteers that I know, I'm thinking of, like, when I've had an assistant where they've been like, I ruined it. And I'm like, okay, I got to talk you out of the tree because it's actually not that bad.
Yeah.
You know, because you've got that kind of given understanding of your relationship that you can, you know, have someone melt down and then build them back up for it. Whereas some people that, you know, it's not a judgment, you just don't have that connection, so it's just a like, oh, do it this way, and it's much more factual in mm-hmm. some ways.
Mm-hmm.
That's just something I've observed over time.
Totally.
So. Starting and ending breaks.
I love my lighting crews. We like to chat. and it can be really hard to be the person who switches from being like, yay, we can take a break until someone tells us to go back to work, to being the one that actually needs to, one, make people take breaks, mm-hmm. and then be the one that says, you know, this is an awesome conversation, but I got to cut it off. We need to get back to work. Like, I have certainly been sitting, you know, on break and been going, crap, and they're all having a really good time, and like, okay, we can have 2 more minutes. Like, how, because that's part of, like, making volunteers happy about the experience, too, is, like, letting them connect with other people and mm-hmm. feeling like they've become a part of the group, and but then you're like, okay, we gotta go. But
I feel like sometimes my most successful volunteer calls is when 2 volunteers that have come in have made a friend.
Yeah.
Because to me, that is the ultimate best thing, because we're humans. I think in the paint world, starting and ending breaks is a little bit more fluid. Like, I always tell people, like, what I find myself saying is, like, make sure you take a break if you need it. The water fountain's here, the bathroom's here, particularly if we're doing, because, like, there's so many different just kind of physical scenarios you can find yourself in painting. Like, painting the floor, like, hunched over like this, like, I'm much more likely to be, like, go, like, stand up and go walk away, because you got to help your back. Whereas if it's, like, a seated painting project, I'm like, you'll take a break when you want it, because, like, I'm not going to babysit you. So for painting, it's a little bit more fluid, and people, I find volunteers are much more likely to be like, I will finish the project and then I will take a break.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit more in the world sometimes of being like, you've been here 4 hours, please go take a break, because you need to. So.
Well, and I think for one of the things that happens, so lighting crews are usually all working on the same step at the same time, and it's also, I just realized, part of it's about keeping the energy up. So if I'm like, okay, it's break time, and I got 2 people who are like, no, we want to finish this thing up, and I'm like, no, really, it's not going to ruin anything if you take a break now. It's like, I need everybody to come down and take a break together, because getting their energy back up to get to work, mm-hmm. it's a lot easier when they all 6 come back in together and go up the ladders. If I've got people trickling in and out, what I've watched is the energy of the room starts to go down, and there's 2 people up on ladders, and they see that nobody else is in the room, and they're like, oh. And so when you've got a crew that's doing the same stuff, they can keep each other's energy moving and keep them, it helps. because I have had crews where people are like, no, I'm going to finish this up, and I'm like, oh, okay. And then I just watch the energy in the room go like this for the next half hour.
And just, you know, if you are working on different projects, being able to pick out kind of a natural stopping point, like plan breaks in ahead of time, make sure that you've got some stops in your projects, or like, is the break the right time to kind of reiterate some of the goals or to bring people back in, or is the break just like, let's hang out and chill for a while? Just kind of, it's again, getting the feel for how the crew's doing, how their energy is. Yeah. I think we've hit most of this one.
I think I want to emphasize it's how you say it in so many instances. I know, Corey, you've given a couple examples of this, but I really can't emphasize that enough, because there's 13 different ways you can say the same thing. So even though you feel like there's only one way to say it, I feel like it's always your responsibility as the leader to really say, I know my communication style, I'm trying to like connect with this person, is this really the best way to say this? Because, you know, paint is paint, but how we talk about the paint makes the experience different. It's a long day. It's a big day. But I think you do eventually get to the point where you're wrapping up. And kind of like what we said at the beginning, you're setting the tone of the call. Like, I always thank everyone who shows up, because no matter, even if like someone did something where I'm like, that took you four times as long as it would take me, it doesn't matter because I didn't have to do it. So like, I thank them for that, because what I said earlier, they have given you the utmost, which is their free time.
I also, if I've got people that were learning, it could be helpful for some of them to hear, like, that's awesome. You know, 4 hours ago you didn't hang lights, and now you really jumped in, and this was great. You know, people that have come back, I often, like, it was great to see you again. Like, crying. Because particularly here, people volunteer over long periods of time, but maybe only they come in twice a year or whatever. So, like, to reinforce that, like, oh, you were back. Like, it's great that you were back. Mm-hmm. You know, and then that helps reinforce the idea that you can come back again. So
I like to kind of summarize at the end of my call, too. I'll be like, all right, guys, today we got, you know, this, this, and this done. We got all these walls built, and that's awesome. And that makes my life super easy because we got them all done. And kind of giving credit where credit's due, making people feel like they contributed something. And like, that's something that they can be proud of, or like reminding someone like, yeah, this will look really great when you see it, see the show in 2 weeks. And like, it'll be really cool to see that thing that you built. You can tell your grandkids. And then a big one in the shop is that end of the day ritual of cleaning up and putting everything back. You know, a clean shop is a safe shop, and it's a good way to instill ownership in the space that people are working in. You know, if someone's putting away tools and then they come back in to volunteer the next time, rather than going, hey, where do you keep all the chisels? They know where the chisels are because they put them away, and that makes them feel like, all right, yeah, I learned something, you know, I understand something more about this place. Or then if you get another new volunteer and they come back, they can tell them where something is and feel like they've got that on lock, like they've been kind of leveling up as a volunteer. And it also just, you know, if you get someone who then goes on to either work in the industry or volunteer in another place, it keeps that sense of like, all right, we always, you know, we clean up the shop. We make sure things are put away and safe, and just, it's good habits to spread out into the world.
I do a similar thing of kind of doing a recap a little bit. I do it slightly differently, in that if I'm like genuinely impressed with how much work has gotten done, I'm like, guys, do you realize how much work got done today? And I think that's something that has actually taken me more time to learn how to positively reinforce than what you would think. Because I think when I was earlier in my career, I was so worried about getting the work done, that over time I have learned that you're more likely to get those repeat volunteers when you can instill that like sense of accomplishment in them. Like you like chose to come here today, and you helped me get so much work done that even I'm impressed, you know, that helps them gauge, you know, how good of a job they did. Because especially when someone has no background, they have no frame of reference for success sometimes. Mm-hmm. So you have to help teach that to them. And then clean up, wash the brushes. No matter what's going on, I'm the number one offender of this. Wash the brushes. So.
Well, yeah, and a lot of the stuff that we end up putting away, I need more than one person. So I really need the crew not to trickle out. Mm-hmm. I'm like, no, we got to put the ladders away, guys. I'm not moving them all by myself. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, also having that sort of, like, expectation that you're not just going to go, okay, I hung my last light, bye. No, no, wait, there's stuff to do. Even if it doesn't seem like there's very much, there's stuff to do.
And I do want to hit that bullet point, remind them if there's other calls coming up, because I have gotten way more repeat volunteers on a show by saying, hey, we have additional calls on Thursday and Saturday if you're free, because then you're much more likely to get a like, oh, am I free? Maybe I could come back in, when they've had a good experience and want to come back again. So I, for myself, if I know I have more calls coming up, I always be like, you coming back? It was fun, wasn't it?
Well, and for lighting, we put out a block of calls at a time. And so I will literally like, hey, am I going to see you on Tuesday? Oh, I don't know. What time are you starting? Well, we're starting at 6, but you could come anytime. We're going to be here till 10. Mm-hmm. Like, having that, like, it's a personal ask. And people respond really, really strongly to a personal ask. Particularly if they've just worked for you, and now you're looking at them going, so, you're coming back, right? They're like, oh.
Especially if you just complimented them.
Right.
After they've been working for you. Or, like, if there's a project that they were working on and they didn't finish it necessarily, and you're like, all right, we're going to keep working on this on Tuesday. Will we see you there?
Yeah.
And then follow-up, I think this can be very different depending on the theater. We have Tony with us today, who does a certain amount of the follow-up for us at TRP.
Yes.
So shout-out at any point, Tony, if you are so inspired. We've mentioned this quite a bit already, but like the follow-up is also the piece that keeps volunteers coming back. Because, you know, it's not just about a volunteer coming in for one call. It's about a volunteer joining your community. And I think, you know, depending on the theater, that can mean different things, but I'm kind of a world, kind of like what you said, Camille, that there's some people where they have been here a long time, but they come twice a year, and it's about honoring that contribution.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the things about the follow-up is if there's something they didn't like about the crew call, they are not at 9:30 at night going to pull me aside and say, I really hate how much you say please and thank you. It's driving me nuts. But 2 days later, they might tell Tony. Or they might at least say, well, it was okay. And that gives her an opening to ask. Like, oh, was there something that could have gone better? Or was there something, you know, that where... And so I love having a different person doing that follow-up. Particularly in Minnesota. I'm a transplant. Y'all don't talk to each other. I am a person who can take that direct feedback, but they don't know that. My crew doesn't know that. So they need someone to express that or to be like, no, I'm not sure I like lighting. And Tony can then go, great, how would you like to try sets? And you can redirect someone into something that they might be happier with. Because the lighting crew call dissatisfaction might have nothing to do with me. It might have to do with, well, I thought that would be fun, but it wasn't.
Or I'm scared of heights.
I didn't know before.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'll be okay on the ladder. And they go up and I'm like, and you need to come down. And we find stuff for them to do, but that's probably not the crew they should sign up for again.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so kind of outside of... you know, we've been very focused on the call, the day of the call, the show, but I think that there is a larger component to just, you know, we're a small, little, gossipy community sometimes, and your reputation as a volunteer leader is sometimes the best thing to get volunteers in, because some people will be like, I ain't helping that person because they're a jerk, and then they'll be like, I'm helping this person because I like them. Mm-hmm. And that is just the human aspect of volunteers. Because people follow people, not organizations. So.
Mm-hmm. I feel like the style point we hit on, you know, that's kind of something you figured out as you're going. The transparency thing, for me, I've worked with a lot of people that until physically you know, I've worked under designers that until you physically show them the two pieces that don't work, they don't believe that they're capable of making a mistake. And nothing frustrates me more than, like, someone who will not at least admit the possibility that there could be an error, even if it wasn't their error. So just knowing, like, you're the crew head, but someone might have a good idea. Someone might not be able to do the thing that you're asking them to do. And just kind of having the ability to say that and understand that just because you've laid out this awesome, you know, 5-point plan, that might go out the window at the last second. And you've got to, you got to own that. You got to be aware that that's something that you're going to have to face.
Mm-hmm.
The last bullet point, some experiences only come from doing. I can't think of an example right now, but there's so many, you know, experiences that you can only learn by doing. There is no textbook for this, or if there is, I haven't found it yet. I should probably write it. There's so many unforeseen circumstances that you can never plan for that you just got to get out there and do it and lead crews and think, well, didn't see that one coming, but I'm going to keep that in my back pocket of experiences moving forward so I don't let that happen again.
I think transparency and humility will get you a really long way. When we were prepping for this, I told these guys about the first. So I'd come out of an undergraduate degree program. I worked on crews. I had you know, one or two people help me with little shows I had done. And I came back after I graduated to design the show for a graduate director's project, which meant I got paid crew from the department. And the paid crew was all the graduate students who I'd just been in classes with. And that year, that graduate year at my school, they had all been recruited, not from schools, but from the field. They all had years more crew experience under their belts than I did. And I was really lucky because one of the guys started getting really frustrated because I was slow in figuring and giving them things. And I heard one of the other graduate students say, chill. She's the first time she's run a crew this big. I was not in a place where I could say that, being all of 22 and going, what the fuck? It's 300 lights. But now I would know to be more transparent, even if they're kind of being professional assholes, was like, hey, this is my first time. We're going to do this. You know, not as an apology, but just like, this is the fact. And I'm learning, and let's go. Let's do this thing together. So sometimes, you know, there's days I've come in when I used to work crazier hours, and I would be like, okay, guys, my brain's not completely here. We're starting here. I know we're going to do this, but, like, don't expect me to think as fast as I normally do. Like, that kind of transparency lets people meet you where you're at and, like, support you and not go, wow, she really, like, doesn't have her shit together.
I also think of transparency in the world of painting because there's some techniques that I can just be like, do this, this, and this because I've done it 13 million times and I know that this is foolproof. And then there's some shows where you will always have the new thing that you've never tried before.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually try and say, just so you all know, I've never done this before. And I usually say that to kind of just be like, I'm still figuring it out / I will probably mess this up too. Mm-hmm. So that also then, again, kind of gives people permission even more to, like, ask questions, feel like they can make mistakes. And sometimes when it's in those situations where I'm like, I've never done this before. If you have input, let me know. Those have actually been the times when someone's made a suggestion, and I'm like, that's brilliant. We're going to do that.
Yep.
So.
I see.
Great. So we're going to end the recording.